You know, sometimes you need a little help in the kitchen, and Blue Apron delivers all of the ingredients you need to make a first-class meal at home. The ingredients are, of course, pre-measured, and they have easy-to-follow recipes which help you make great meals in about 40 minutes or less. You can try quinoa and black bean burgers with sweet potato oven fries and garlic lime sauce, or za'atar chicken and farro salad with beet, goat cheese, and pistachios. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/ATK to get your first two meals free. You know, I care about the little things, and oddly enough, that actually includes shaving. What I love is a razor that's well-made and also does the job well. At Harry's, they cut out the middlemen, so you pay just a fraction of the cost of the drugstore brands. Their starter set is just $15, and that includes the razor, three blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming shave gel. You also get $5 off your first purchase with our code KITCHEN, and shipping is always free. That's HARRYS.com, and enter coupon code KITCHEN at checkout for $5 off the starter set and start shaving smarter today. This is Christopher Kimball. Thank you for downloading this week's podcast. You can head over to our website, which is atkradio.com. We post our recipes, equipment reviews, taste test results, and also our wine recommendations. Enjoy this week's show. This is America's Test Kitchen from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org, and I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. This week from the Test Kitchen, a new museum in New York examines the role of food and drink in our culture. Their current exhibit documents the confusing world of natural and artificial flavors. For example, is a chemical, no matter where it comes from? Dave Arnold and Peter Kim share their world with us, a place of food chemistry, food marketing, and a very rich culinary history.
I can't exactly put a boundary around why I believe this, but it does mean something to me that orange juice comes from an orange and it would be squeezed from an orange, even if that orange itself has been the result of decades of breeding and manipulation.
Also on our show today, we learn how to make homemade pasta, and our wine expert introduces us to an underappreciated Italian grape, Verdicchio. But first, it's time for this week's Test Kitchen Tip. Many home cooks wonder if they can substitute non-fat buttermilk for low-fat, so we tested flaky buttermilk biscuits and also buttermilk pancakes, and they worked well with either choice. However, when we made buttermilk pie, the non-fat buttermilk turned out slices that were both grainy and slightly curdled. The fat in low-fat buttermilk helps to prevent eggs from curdling in a custard. So we prefer low-fat to non-fat, although the latter will work very nicely in standard baking applications as long as no custard is involved. Coming up, we take your calls, but first we head into the test kitchen for this week's taste test. Jack, how are you?
I'm well, Chris.
We're in the test kitchen, and it looks like three little tiny bowls of brown rice.
You are correct. The question we have here is, you know, the big issue with brown rice is the amount of time it takes to cook it. And so we rounded up all of the national brands of regular dry rice that you need to cook for 45 minutes to an hour, depending on the recipe that you're reading, versus convenience rices. And so some of these are ready to serve. You just simply microwave them. We tested one that was frozen, and you just simply thawed the rice, and it was ready to serve. We learned a couple of things. Most of the convenience rices, as you might imagine, were not very good. They were really, really mushy and soggy. And even in a recipe where the rice isn't the star, we felt like they weren't even good enough for that. Although there was one exception, one convenience rice that we did like. Second thing we learned is absolutely do not read the package instructions if you're cooking dry, regular old brown rice. The amount of water for one cup of rice varied from 1 3/4 cups to 2.5 cups, depending on which package you were looking at. More than 1 3/4 cups, and you end up with really, really mushy, soggy brown rice. So we found the second thing we have to do is, in order to get good brown rice, if we're going to cook it ourselves, we need to use our recipe, not the package recipes. So you've been sampling these three different bowls. I will say that the package rices, as you might imagine, contain ingredients other than brown rice.
I noted that in one of these samples.
Yes.
A little salty.
They contain some salt. Some contain some oil to keep the grains separate. You know, that could be an issue depending on the recipe, but I think if you know going in that you're using something that's already been pre-seasoned and has a little bit of oil in it, you can just dial back the amount of fat or salt you'd be adding in the recipe.
I do have a question. If you have a multi-million dollar rice company, wouldn't you get the basic recipe on the back of the package properly tested?
You would, except the big problem people have with brown rice is that they worry about scorching it. So my theory is a lot of companies call for extra water, so at least you don't scorch it and it's just mushy.
Right.
But I guess, you know, mushy is better than burnt for many of these manufacturers, and at least it's not an obvious fail. Obviously, here in the test kitchen, if you have mushy brown rice, you have failed.
That's a nice choice, mushy or burned. Well, the three samples in order. I liked the first one. I thought it was the flavor wasn't off, was decently chewy. The second one, there's nothing wrong with the flavor. I thought the texture suffered a little bit. It was a little too soft compared to number one. And number three clearly had additives, had salt and oil and some other stuff in it. Texture was not very good either, so I really did not like number three. So one, two, three, that's my order.
Well, let's start with number one, your favorite.
Oh, yes. I love it.
You chose the Minute ready-to-serve brown rice, which was actually, of the convenience products that we tested, our favorite. So at least you chose the right convenience product.
Man, I'm right there with Minute. I love it.
You're easy. Just put it in the microwave and you're ready to go, Chris.
I just have to buy a microwave first. My number two choice was?
You chose our least favorite among the convenience products. This is Uncle Ben's Ready Rice. This one we felt like the texture really suffered. Another microwave one, but right. It just wasn't very good.
And the one I really hated is probably the real deal, right?
You hated real brown rice, Chris.
Man, I did not like this one at all.
This is our top rated. It's from California, family-run company Lundberg. We thought this was the best of the brown rice samples that we tried.
Now, usually, either I'm right, or if I'm wrong, you convince me of my bad ways in the kitchen. I have to say this time, though, that the real rice was gluey, glutinous, and a bit salty.
I think you're being overly harsh about this poor sample of brown rice. I will say that because the ready rices are coated with oil, they are less starchy because the grains are more separate. I think the product you didn't like, which was the natural, real brown rice, you don't like the fact that it's a little starchy, which is the natural condition for brown rice.
So I didn't like natural. Well, the winner was natural. It was organic brown long grain rice from Lundberg. The winner of the convenience brown rices was Minute ready-to-serve brown rice. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. You can find today's show and all of our weekly shows on atkradio.com and also on iTunes. We also post our weekly recipes, reviews, wine tastings, and taste test results. Now it's time to take some calls. Of course, joining me is our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster. How are you?
I am fantastic.
That's very British of you. Fantastic.
I'm fantastic.
Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Natalie from Florida.
Hi, Natalie from Florida. How are you?
Good.
So how can we help you in the kitchen?
I use Pyrex baking pans, the glass ones. I also have some really nice clay baking pans, you know, more pottery type.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the books and online instructions say if you're using anything but a metal baking pan, that you should decrease the temperature of the oven by 25 degrees. Is there any truth to this?
The short answer is maybe. It depends on what you're baking in the pan, more so than the pan itself. So a lot of people say, especially if it's a dark metal pan, you should decrease the temperature by 25 degrees. And that sometimes we do say. It's helpful to know what the different types of material do. So a metal pan will give you more of a browned edge. So if you're baking something like brownies and you want a little bit of that more developed crust around the edge, you could do that. Or cinnamon buns are great in a metal pan.
It depends if it's dark metal or light metal, right?
That's true as well. The reason that we love to use glass is you can see the bottom. So if you're baking a pie or basically anything, you can lift that pan up and see if the bottom is done.
I think there's one other word of caution, though. Many years ago, Bridget does remember this, like it was yesterday, you took a very hot Pyrex pan, a casserole dish, out of the oven and placed it on a wet counter.
Yes.
And maybe you could tell our listeners what happened.
Yeah, that's happened a couple of times. Yeah. Not all my fault. Not all three times.
I didn't say
happened.
It was your fault. I was just saying it happened to you.
So when you take especially a hot glass pan, you put it on a cold surface, and often stone counters are very cool, especially if it's cool and wet. There's a shock, the temperature shock that happens to the glass, and it contracts and explodes.
And then a shock to the cook.
And it's a big shock to the cook, yes. This also happens not with just baking pans, but things like glass measuring cups. If you're heating something in the microwave, it gets very, very hot. I remember we were doing a microwave roux.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we took it out, put it on a stone countertop, and tick, 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 boom. That's what happened. So you do need to be careful with glass pans. Always use a cooling rack when you take it out.
The short answer is no, there is no easy rule
right.
about reducing oven temperature. The only thing to really think about is very dark metal pans will retain and conduct heat very well and transfer it. And that will overbrown in many cases. I think with Pyrex or anything else, I don't bother changing oven temperature.
Yeah.
I mean, you just check everything constantly to know what's done. And that's a rule. Halfway through baking, turn it around the oven. And I start checking halfway through. And I check all the time because baking times are never accurate. Because one oven versus another is totally different.
What I have noticed is that clay, they do get hot. They absolutely do brown quicker.
Then go ahead, reduce the oven temperature 25 degrees for that and see where you end up. I have some clay pots when I was a hippie in the early 70s.
I bet you did.
Yeah. We cook brown rice in them. And rutabaga. I was the worst cook.
Yes?
In my commune.
Back then.
No, actually, I was the best cook in the commune, but that didn't mean anything.
Comparatively?
Comparatively.
Yes.
Natalie, I hope we covered your question and many other things.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
you
take care.
Bye-bye.
Don't you like when people call up with a simple question? We go on about hippies.
And, yes, yeah, I
exploding
like that.
Dishes. And, yeah. You didn't talk about your dog.
Though. No.
Yeah.
That's next one. Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Mike from Montreal.
Hi, Mike from Montreal. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Very well. So how can we help you today, Mike?
I'm phoning about maple syrup. It's
I heard they have maple syrup in Canada.
Yes, we do. It's the land of maple syrup. We're born in one hand with a hockey stick and the other hand with maple syrup.
Well, that's not a bad life.
No, no. I have a lot of trouble finding recipes to cook maple syrup. And I was wondering whether or not you can swap out different liquid sweeteners for maple syrup, like corn syrup, but eliminate that, or even maple sugar used instead of regular sugar or brown sugar. And also, with regards to the type of maple syrup, light, medium, or amber, does it make any difference if you're cooking with it?
Well, since I'm the resident maple syrup quote-unquote expert.
Yes, you are.
We have about 4,800 taps in our farm in Vermont and make a lot. I would say for cooking, always use the darkest you can find. When I was a kid, fancy grade A was all people made. I don't think that has. It's just sweet. It's almost like corn syrup, but the really almost black. Matter of fact, one year I burned the pan, which is something you don't want to do. Great syrup.
Oh, really?
It was like it really had that almost bitter darkness to it, which I loved. So dark is great. You can substitute for corn syrup. The chemistry of the two things are a little different. But I think you could, I would substitute half the corn syrup maybe with maple syrup.
Right.
I would not substitute maple syrup for a dry, like sugar. That doesn't work because the chemistry is totally different.
Right.
Maple sugar, the crystallized sugar, is probably a little less sweet than regular sugar. You might have to add more. I would substitute some of the corn syrup out. Like, for example, pecan pie, we have a maple pecan pie.
Right.
Which uses some amount of maple syrup. But in general, swapping out one sugar for another is a little dicey, especially if you go from liquid to dry or dry to liquid.
Yeah, but there's not that many recipes that call for maple syrup. Even if it says maple syrup pie, you look, it's mainly brown sugar. So that's why I'm trying to figure out how I can do it.
I would use it in recipes, for example, like a cobbler or something like that, where the sugar isn't important in terms of creating structure or helping to create a texture in a cake.
Right.
If it ends up being a liquid at the end, you're probably okay. But if it ends up in a solid, like a cake or brownie, swapping in maple syrup is going to be a little dicey. I would think of it as a flavoring, not as the main sweet.
And it's great for cooking applications, too, if you want to do as a glaze, you know, pork tenderloin, things like that. Maple's a great flavor, right, at the end, especially with a little bit of cayenne and some other flavors in
there. We had a recipe with a nonstick skillet, two pork tenderloins, right? We reduced some maple syrup down and then
just start rotating the tenderloin.
Bathed the tenderloins in the skillet and then put that whole thing in the oven to finish.
That was great.
Oh, that's a great recipe.
There's nothing better than pork with maple syrup.
And you can use a lot of maple syrup in that recipe. I think it was at least half a cup.
It was a half a cup.
Yeah, half a cup. So there you go. Do that once a month
perfect.
And you'll run out of your inventory.
Exactly.
And that'll give you plenty of time to play hockey.
That's right.
Exactly. So. You have to burn off the maple syrup.
You do.
Mike, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
have
pleasure.
A good day.
Yeah,
thanks,
you too.
You too.
Okay.
This is America's Test Kitchen. I'm Christopher Kimball here with our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster. Give us a ring anytime, 855-34-COOKS. That's 855-34-COOKS. Or email us at questions@atkradio.com. Now it's time for another call.
Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Matt from Walpole, Massachusetts.
How are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm very well. And how can we help you today?
I had a question on one of the recipes in Yotam Ottolenghi's cookbook, Jerusalem. It's on roasted potatoes.
Yes, and well, we have an expert here.
Yes, I've cooked almost every one of his recipes in all four of his books, yes.
All right, good. In this one, they say to roast the potatoes in goose fat, which is not something I've ever seen in the grocery store I go to.
So oh, come on, it's everywhere.
Right. I didn't know, you know, one, what could I substitute for goose fat, and two, does goose fat bring anything to these potatoes that I wouldn't get from roasting them normally?
Yes, it has a tremendous amount of flavor. That's why the French, for example, will roast potatoes in duck fat or goose fat. I would say chicken fat, which you probably can get, would be the easiest to find substitute, which would add a lot of flavor. If you just use an oil, which is fine, you're just not going to get that deep flavor.
Right. And those types of fat, goose fat, chicken fat, even lard, really good quality lard, which, again, like the chicken fat, you can start finding those. And sometimes you find them in the freezer section, just so you know. All these have a nice, pretty high smoke point. So if you were to go and use bacon fat, which it's hard.
That's what I tried.
That's too strong, and it's also because it hasn't been refined, it hasn't been purified, filtered
smoked
several times. It can start to smoke at a much lower temperature and give the potatoes, you know, depending on the recipe, a little bit more of an acrid, strong flavor. So
we've been working together for 20 years. I just want to note for the record, it's the first time you said anything slightly negative about a pork product. It's a first.
What I'm saying is you would have to change probably the recipe to work with the bacon fat, right?
Okay. All right.
And then another fat that I've been using a lot is beef tallow, and it is great. So it's just rendered beef fat, and you can find this at a butcher, or you ask them for beef fat, and you render it yourself. It's very easy to do. It's just, you know, cut it in small pieces and roast it slowly in the oven, or if you have a slow cooker, it's actually great for beef tallow. And it makes amazing roast potatoes. It has a very high smoke point.
He asked about a substitute for goose fat.
Right.
And you're suggesting you go to the butcher and render your own beef tallow?
Well, after you use the chicken fat.
Chicken fat. This. Yeah, you can get chicken fat.
Schmaltz.
Schmaltz, yeah. That would be the easiest substitute. I mean,
okay. and smoke point is about the same as the goose fat, so I could cook
and,
it.
And duck fat is something.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the same smoke point. They're both about 375.
Okay.
And
then
you can use oil, too. It's just you're not going to get that extra flavor. And the recipe will work fine.
Okay, that's awesome.
And if you can, go on the internet and try to source goose fat, because you can find it. And that way you can try it yourself.
Great. I will try that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah.
Thanks. Bye.
Render your own beef tallow? What? Jeez.
I think you have an Ottolenghi tattoo somewhere upon you, don't you?
Not where the sun shines. Don't. I'm Christopher Kimball, and you're listening to America's Test Kitchen. You can find today's show and all of our weekly shows on iTunes, also on our website, atkradio.com, where we post all of our recipes, tastings, and testings. Coming up later, I visit the Museum of Food and Drink with Dave Arnold and Peter Kim to find out whether there's any difference between natural and artificial flavor. Over many years, I've found that even the most famous food writers and chefs often cheat when it comes to dinner. You know what I mean, an omelet or unheated leftovers eaten standing at the sink, or even a bowl of cold cereal. Now, you could do takeout or run out for a quick meal, but there is a more elegant solution to this problem of what's for dinner, and it's called Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers all the ingredients you need to make first-rate recipes for creating really interesting meals in about half an hour or less. You can try lemon butter shrimp and tomato rice or tomato quiche with a simple green salad. This is a much more interesting and a better way to cook. So visit blueapron.com/ATK to get your first two meals absolutely free. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Dave Arnold, a former sculptor, had a dream, a museum in New York called the Museum of Food and Drink. Peter Kim, a lawyer, liked the idea so much that he left his firm to become the museum's executive director. This very strange world includes a working model of the puffing gun, uses steam under pressure to produce breakfast cereals such as corn puffs, an investigation into what makes a flavor artificial versus natural, and of course, the science of food, how an enzyme can make a superior French fry. I started by asking about the chemical differences between natural and artificial flavors. So you have an exhibit, it was written up in the New York Times recently, about flavor, making it and faking it. So let me ask a basic question, which I've asked of our own science folks. What really is the difference between natural flavor and artificial flavor? You know, a chemical is a chemical. What's the difference?
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of it goes back to, you know, definitions that were kind of put in place in the early part of the 20th century. So it really just boils down to whether or not it comes from the material. In other words, if you're making grape flavor from something that isn't a normal foodstuff or, you know, isn't, then it's artificial. Whereas the exact same chemical derived from grapes is natural. So they're chemically identical, but if they don't come from the natural food in question, then they're artificial or they're natural from other derivations. So you can have what's called WAMF, which is with other natural flavors added. So like, you know, you'll have natural grape flavor, WAMF, with other natural flavors that come from other things that are foodstuffs but aren't the foodstuff in question. But I think the reason it's kind of disingenuous or it's not a good real term to use is that when you say natural, it gives the impression that somehow it's not been dorked with. and in fact, you know, all of these, you know, in quotes, natural flavors have been heavily, heavily worked on and processed. So it's just when you're buying something that's natural, you're not buying what you think you're buying. And I think that's the problem.
Yeah, and I mean, I think actually just more broadly, I just want to chime in. I think there's one of the things I really love about the exhibition that we did is that it dives into some deeper questions about what natural even means more broadly. And if you think about it, there's very little in food that you could really call truly natural because everything down to the fruits and vegetables that we eat, you know, have been bred in particular ways. Cooking is, of course, a human intervention into the natural environment. And so in a way, everything is artificial. And so, you know, I think there's really just a sort of a continuum of how much humans do manipulate things. And this is something that we explore in the exhibition as well.
So a molecular structure, a chemical, is a chemical. End of story. Right?
Bingo.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, what's weird about it is that still to this day, even though it's been since the early 1800s that people have realized that the chemicals in our body, you know, the ones that make up organic living creatures, are no different from the chemicals that are floating around in the dead world and the, you know, in the non-living world, we still somehow seem to think that they're different. Even though scientifically we know otherwise, in our soul there's still this kind of residual vitalism that's left over where we think that, you know, the vanillin that's produced in a vanilla bean is somehow more pure, somehow better, or somehow different. It's not the case.
Okay, so let me give you a hard case. Let's do frozen orange juice, okay? So they put it in million-gallon vats, takes oxygen out, so they store it. Basically, it has no flavor. And before they reconstitute it and sell it, they put back in flavoring agents, you know, these packets, which are made from various parts of the orange. So that's a case of technology, I guess, using all natural ingredients because everything's coming from an orange, but they're putting the orange juice to sleep into an inert phase, bringing it back, putting back flavor packets into it. How do you feel about that? Is that natural?
It just doesn't taste as good. It just doesn't taste as good.
No, it doesn't taste as good, but forget about that. But just in terms of whether you think that's artificial or natural, which one is it?
Well, it's natural, which is what the perverse thing is, even though it's all artifice, right? So it's like, it is like, you know, this huge technical separation and recombination with fidelity law situation that you're going on, and yet it's all natural. But that's why the definition is bad. That's why, like, thinking about things in terms of artificial and natural in the kind of legal technical way that it's defined in this country is not so useful.
So how would you define it? How should we define
futzed
it?
Futzed with. It's been futzed with. You know what I mean? It's and it just doesn't taste as good. I think
in
we should focus more on whether it's
in other
good.
Words, you'd have manipulated food and non-manipulated food.
Well, I don't know. I would just have high quality and low quality. And, like, you know, you would go buy the high quality orange juice because it tastes good.
That's where I would sort of deviate from Dave. You know, I think, you know, I can't exactly put a boundary around why I believe this, but it does mean something to me that it comes from an orange and it would be squeezed from an orange, even if that orange itself has been the result of decades of breeding and manipulation.
Let's go back to the Kellogg Institute, breakfast cereal, Mr. Post, who stole the idea from Kellogg, as I remember from my history book. You guys ran around with a 3,000-pound cannon that was used to puff cereal. So going back to that time, how was technology used to create the first breakfast cereals, and how does the puffing gun work?
Basically, Kellogg, when they started, he was a Seventh-day Adventist, and they were very religious and also very interested in kind of problems of the body and trying to reduce in a very real way the kind of pleasure that you get out of eating. So kind of a real negation of the hedonistic side of eating. So they were inventing all of these technologies to convert relatively tasteless starches into even more tasteless, kind of easy to consume and fully digest, right? So the idea is you want to fully digest things, and you don't want to tax your digestive system too much, because that was seen as somehow wasting your energy and kind of going to ruin you. Remember, this is the time of kind of a degeneration. These people were also, by the way, eugenicists, and like had like, you know, a lot of really bizarre kind of views. And so they were inventing technologies, these kind of dietetic technologies, one of which was flakers, like making flake cereals, which was one of his early kind of inventions. And then another one is the puffing gun.
And you guys had or have an actual puffing gun, right? And you bring it around to different events. So explain in layman's terms how this thing works.
So I think the best way to think about the puffing gun is to refer back to something that everybody kind of intuitively understands, just popcorn. You know, what happens in popcorn is you heat it up, and popcorn has this hull, and, you know, the moisture inside the popcorn turns into steam, and then at a certain point it can't, because there's just it just can't go anywhere. And so the pressure builds and builds until the hull ruptures, and at that point the steam bursts out, and then the starch inside the corn kernel sort of blossoms out, which is why you get the shape of, when you look at popcorn, it looks almost like a flower.
The modernist cuisine, sound waves in water to do French fries, oil of pistachio to make gelato. What do you think of that use of science?
I'm much more fond of using an enzyme called Pectinex Ultra SPL to modify the surface of my French fries. But I do applaud what they're doing with their French fry recipe.
Wait. So explain what you just said.
So French fries in particular are a difficult problem, because what you're trying to do is get the interior texture of the potato to be a certain way and have the exterior be a different way. And there's kind of an argument because of moisture migration between the inside of the potato and the outside of the potato. And so it's very easy to get a French fry that's good, hot. And it's not so easy to get a French fry that stays good as it cools down. So a lot has to do with moisture, which is why, like, you know, people who believe in the kind of double fry or blanch, dry, double fry kind of a technique tend to dehydrate the French fry quite a bit. But I think that kind of hurts the interior texture. So right. A lot of what you do to try to fix this problem on the crust is to damage in some way the surface of the French fry prior to the fry. So they're using ultrasound to do some damage to the outside of the fry. But like I use a pectinase enzyme instead that kind of disturbs the surface of the French fry on an initial soak and provides the kind of crust that I want. But, you know, like, it's not that you need to do that, but it's just, you know, that's where the investigation of the fry has brought me.
So for the people listening to the show, do you have one or two suggestions about applying science to how they cook at home in some easy way?
I think it's, aside from any one bit of science, just paying closer attention to what you're doing when you're cooking. I mean, look, that's something that, you know, you've been doing since forever. In fact, you know, I literally yesterday in the 1993, I forget which month of Cook's Illustrated, was a recipe called One Dough, Many Cookies.
Eric Bruce did that. Yeah,
I still use that recipe, but yeah. Every time I make it, I make it a little different. But, you know, building on that concept of the breakdown of what's changing from time to time. As long as you're paying attention to how you're altering something like that, you'll get a little bit better each time or a little worse, and then you can dial it back. But I think that's the one thing, if you have to figure out what's going to make you better about thinking scientifically in the kitchen, it's paying attention to what you're doing, observing and learning from your practice so that you can get better every day.
First, there were flake cereals such as cornflakes, and then the puffing gun was invented by a guy called Thomas James. He worked in the electrical engineering department of General Foods in the 1940s. It transformed breakfast cereal, including Lucky Charms, Cocoa Puffs, and Trix. Today, technology may take us farther into the future by offering peanut butter and jellyfish sandwiches and headless chicken farms and three-course meal chewing gum. Robert Oppenheimer once said about an early atom bomb test, quote, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." Maybe he shouldn't have worried about the future of man. Technology spends most of its time bringing us Lucky Charms and better chewing gum. You know, it really could be a whole lot worse. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Coming up after the break, an easier way to make homemade pasta, and we investigate an underappreciated Italian grape, Verdicchio. My favorite breakfast cereal is steel cut oats, and I am happy to say that Bob's Red Mill proudly supports this podcast. Bob's Red Mill steel cut oats help lower cholesterol. They also provide protein and fiber. However, I enjoy them strictly for the taste and texture. I find that they cook up faster than coarser steel cut oats, which does save a bit of time in the morning. They also go perfectly with almost any topping. I like dried fruit and nuts. To a recipe I found in Austria last summer, a drizzle of melted brown butter with maple syrup. Find Bob's Red Mill steel cut oats along with recipes and serving suggestions at bobsredmill.com. Now, there are some things in life that appear to be a mystery. Getting a consistently tasty cup of coffee, why some folks buy pancake, not real syrup, and why some mattresses cost a fortune and turn out to be too soft. Well, life is too short. You know, I want a great cup of coffee, real maple syrup, and a firm, well-made mattress, and I don't want to have to think about it. That's one reason that America's Test Kitchen is supported by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses at a fraction of the price. With great engineering at a low price, you get the best of both worlds. Try sleeping on a Casper risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and easy returns. All Casper hybrid mattresses are made here in America, and pricing is $500 for a twin size and $950 for king. America's Test Kitchen listeners can get $50 toward any mattress by visiting casper.com/kitchen and using promotion code KITCHEN at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Coming up, as we do every week, we answer your questions. Give us a ring, 855-34-COOKS. That's 855-34-COOKS. But now it's time for another wine tasting. And this week, we learn all about Verdicchio. It's an Italian white wine poured in hundreds of small restaurants and fish shacks along the Adriatic coast. I'm here with our wine expert, Stephen Muse, at Formaggio Kitchen in Cambridge. Stephen, how are you?
Good, Chris. How are you?
This is a white wine day.
Yeah, it's a white wine day. We've got four white wines to taste. I'm betting that this is a category that will be new to you, or at least maybe sort of unfamiliar. These are all wines that I think sort of fly under the radar a little bit. Now, every one of these are made from a single grape. The grape is called Verdicchio. They're from a region in central Italy called the Marche. It's only grown in this one area. We don't really see it anywhere else. And I think it's kind of unique, and I think your listeners need to know about it, and that's why we're going to taste some today.
Now, I remember back in the early 70s, I was going to school in New York. There was an Italian restaurant, 11th or 12th and 5th. It was where you took the hot date, where you had $40 at the time that was dinner. Uh-huh. And the straw, the bottles and the straw thing and the candles. Didn't they have Verdicchio? I mean, it seemed to me that they served Verdicchio there.
Yes, Verdicchio did have its, what I would call its kitsch phase.
Yeah.
Along with Lambrusco and Soave, Bartolino, and a few other Italian wines, where they were taken up by big industrial production houses and just really pretty debased. So we're not anywhere near that territory today. These are all small production, all naturally made wine. I think they're really delicious. But you're going to tell me, because you're about to taste wine number one.
Okay, wine number one. Very nice. It's not too sweet. It has a little... not bitterness, but it's got some bite to it, which I really like.
Yeah.
A nice finish. I like a lot.
I think you've actually hit all the three key points there, Chris. We're going to go back to each of them one at a time. Try wine number two.
Little sweeter, smoother, doesn't have as much structure to it, I think, is number one. Very nice, though. Wine number three. Yeah, I thought wine number three is a little bit like a combination of one and two.
Yeah.
Had a little bit of bite, number one, but slightly sweeter, and wine number four. I don't know. Wine number four is a little different. There's a little more going on. It's a little more complex. It has more angles to it. It's interesting.
Well, Chris, I have to say, I think that your analysis of the wines is pretty perceptive, because many people, including me occasionally, find ourselves a little bit lost for words when it comes to describing these wines. And I think this is the reason why. There's plenty of fruit in these wines, but it doesn't seem to occupy center stage. Right. It seems to be there supporting everything in abundance. There's plenty of it. But the wines are not what you would describe as fruity. They evolve into something like maybe green herbs and then into a very, very dry finish. So subdued apple fruit, a little bit of something green like green herbs or olives, and then a finish that reminds some people of something nutty like almonds. So that seems to be the rundown for Verdicchio. So the first wine that you tasted, the Loratello from Cantina Politi, is a $15 wine. So good idea to like that one. You can drink that one every night. Wine number two, an all-natural wine from Calyptra called Kiptra. And I agree, a little bit more subtle, a little bit more elegant kind of wine, more delicate. Bellevalier from Stefano Antonucci, a little more fruit, a little more generous. And then finally, the one that kind of stumped you is the Terra Salvate from La Distesa. Now, this is a wine that tells us something about the history of Verdicchio, because in this part of the world, before modern winemaking came along, all of the wines in there were made in a slightly oxidized style, even macerated on their skins just a little bit. So you got a little grip, you got a little color, and you got a little oxidation. And this is a bit of a throwback to that style.
So these are all from the same region, right?
Yes, they're not only from the same region, but then they're a very circumscribed area. They're all, you know, all of these wines are made in a circle of about a 20-mile radius.
Which is where, again, in Italy?
On the east coast, on the Adriatic, in the central part of Italy.
So you said earlier, when I was a youth, that these were mass-produced, kind of, you know, large-scale, poor-quality wines. Now they've gone back to higher quality. So I go into a store, I just ask for Verdicchio or a particular place of origin?
You can pretty much just ask for Verdicchio, because this grape isn't really planted anywhere else. I mean, this is ground zero for Verdicchio.
And I'm drinking this by itself. I probably want to drink this with food, and I bet you have a suggestion.
Well, it is the classic seafood wine of that part of the world. So it's really great, maybe not so much with the whitefish, like a halibut or cod, but with something like a grilled branzino or a little bit richer fish, or a fish made in a sauce or a fish stew or something like that. Really fantastic.
So the takeaway is Verdicchio. It's sort of a forgotten and reimagined white wine.
Yeah.
It's from the Adriatic coast. It tends to be small production, and it's great with seafood.
Yes, that's it. And our listeners can get more details about the wine on our website, atkradio.com.
Now it's time to open up our phone lines and take a few phone calls. And with me once again is our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster. How are you?
I'm fantastic, Chris. How are you doing?
I don't look as good as you, but I'm feeling well.
Enough said. Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Russell.
Hi, Russell. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
You're very well. I'm here with Mr. Kimball, also known as Chris.
I'm so excited to talk to you guys. You're like my two favorite chefs.
Well, thank you. So how can we help you today?
So I had a question about creaming butter.
Okay.
I see a lot of recipes where it says to have your butter soft, that you can cream it. And I know it can't be melted, but I was wondering if you can put butter like from the refrigerator into the KitchenAid and just kind of beat it up a little bit instead of softening it. Would that work as well, or do you really have to let
Well, there is a trick. The problem with the show is that I have some suggestions that are not approved.
They're not sanctioned.
They're not sanctioned by the committee at America's Test Kitchen. One of the things you can do, I'm like you, sometimes I don't think ahead, like ever. So I get a kitchen towel, and I put it under very hot water. And I wrap the outside of the mixing bowl. Bridget's going like, I don't think so. Wrap the outside of the bowl and then cream the butter. That actually does a pretty good job. The other way is the microwave. Now, again, I have a difference of opinion. I use 10% power.
I don't have a microwave.
Oh, either, you know, actually, neither do I. So we'll eliminate that. 10% power would work. But cut it into tablespoon pieces. Let it sit about half an hour in a warm kitchen. That'll get you. Yeah. You want about 67 degrees, cool room temperature.
Right, and spread those pieces out onto a plate. Yeah. Or you can put it on a metal tray, which will, you know, if it's warm in your kitchen, it'll conduct the heat a little bit more for 15, 20 minutes. And you basically want it to still look waxy, but when you press in the middle of it, it seems a little bit soft.
It should be malleable.
Malleable, yes.
Okay.
Just because I think it's cool. Try the hot wet kitchen towel trick. That actually does work.
Okay, and you just put that right around the mixing bowl.
Yeah, just wrap it around the mixing bowl, and then you have to re-wet it a couple times because it'll cool off. And I find that actually works. And you'd have to increase the time for creaming. You know, it's Bridget's going like, I can't believe he's on the show with me.
I wonder if you could use a heating pad, those kind that wrap around you. Wrap it around my head.
Yeah, so it's either half an hour spread out at room temperature or the hot towel.
All right, I will definitely try that.
All right.
Thanks, Russell.
Take care, Russell.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
I just love it when I go off the resume.
I saw that.
I know.
You're going rogue.
Dope slap.
Going rogue, slap. Kimball. Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Katie from Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Hi, Katie. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very well. Chris is, I think, well. You okay, Chris?
I've been to Wisconsin twice in the last month.
That's true.
I'm a big fan of Wisconsin, so how can we help you?
We have really great farmers markets here, and in the spring they have this wonderful asparagus, but I can never figure out how to clean out all the grit from the asparagus. And it just breaks my heart every time it's sandy asparagus. And I was wondering if you had any tips.
So you're specifically talking about the tip end, the little...
It might be all over. We have really sandy soil in Eau Claire.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's at the tip or all over, or I just know when I bite, just like biting into, you know,
Well, I don't think it would be on the tip because that isn't under...
Sure, that's above soil.
Yeah, I've told you this story before when I planted asparagus the first time, 25 years ago.
It just came up this year.
Finally. It took forever. But man, they're big. No, I did the whole thing and I bought a bunch of them and I planted them upside down. Yeah, I did. And they came up.
They
did a 180 and they came up.
Wow.
Yeah. That just shows I got the green thumb.
Determined little buggers, aren't they?
Despite my best efforts, they came up. I would just get a big bowl and water and smush them around like you would leeks, you know? Yeah. Do that, and you might even, if you wanted to, peel off the thicker ends.
Yeah.
Just use a peeler and peel them down as well. But I would think if you just swish them around in a big bowl of water, you can take the lettuce spinner and take everything out except the bowl
and use that,
which is light and easy to use.
I also have, for scrubbing vegetables, I use an unused nail brush, which I find I like that because it's a smaller little brush and you can get into more areas. And I use that for scrubbing vegetables, but that might be perfect for this because they're soft enough to get the grit without kind of marring the vegetable.
Oh, that's a good idea.
That is a good idea.
Thanks. That's why my nails are always so clean.
How to go to the pharmacy and buy cooking utensils.
Yes. There you go.
That's it.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks. I'll give that a shot.
Thanks so much, Katie. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Just a reminder to give us a ring, 855-34-COOKS, 855-34-COOKS, or email us at questions@atkradio.com.
This is Marianne.
Hi, Marianne. Where are you calling from?
Long Island, New York.
Oh, fantastic. So how can we help you today?
I'm fortunate. I have chickens in my backyard, so I get a lot of fresh eggs, and I make quiche. And I run into a problem when I make quiche or an egg bake of any kind that the edges are done, but the center is still at an unsafe temperature. And I was wondering if you could help me solve that problem so that the outer edge wouldn't be overcooked when the center was still, you know, raw.
What oven temperature are you using?
350 degrees.
Well, check that off, because that's the right temperature. And tell us about, though, your liquids, like eggs, cream, milk. What are the ratios here?
That's where I get a little creative. I usually use eggs and half, maybe six eggs, maybe half a cup of half and half. a little less.
Oh, okay, that's the problem.
Yep.
You need a much higher ratio of liquid to eggs. We do about 3 cups of liquid, maybe half cream, half milk,
right,
to 8 eggs. So what's happening is those eggs are
setting.
Setting very quickly. But if you had a higher ratio of liquid to eggs, it would take more time to set, and therefore you're not going to have those edges get tough
fast. Okay,
because
I'm trying to use up eggs and have more protein in there, but that's not really a good idea then, because the edges are overcooked and it just doesn't taste good.
I would say per cup of liquid you need 2.5 eggs or something, right?
That sounds about right. Yeah. I mean, you think about when you make scrambled eggs and you put the eggs in a hot pan, they set almost immediately.
You're right.
But if you were to mix that with a lot of milk and tried to do the same thing, it's going to take a lot of time for the eggs to set.
Oh, that's a big help. I have to follow the recipe.
Hey, that's an idea. Wow. I've never thought of that before.
I cook a lot. So something like a quiche, I could just throw together some eggs and cream and some cheese and bacon, and I'm good.
As soon as you said improvise, I went, oh, we got
problems.
Especially
with baking.
Yeah, well, you don't want to improvise quiche. I mean, once you get the ratios down, then you can improvise the flavors. But
yes,
the ratio's important.
That's a great option. Yeah. I'm going to go on your website and look up the quiche recipe.
We did a deep dish quiche, Lorraine, recently.
That was good.
And that is amazing. And it uses a little bit of cornstarch in it as well. And that helps prevent the eggs from becoming too tight too quickly.
Oh.
So definitely try that one. It's a great recipe.
So it's a cup and a half of milk, a cup and a half of cream, 8 eggs.
Yep.
Plus a yolk, I think. But that's the basic concept.
That's wonderful. Thank you so
much.
I'm going to try that this weekend.
And before you improvise, sit down and take a timeout. And just think long and hard.
About what you've done.
About what you're about to do. Right.
So. Chris and Bridget gave me a timeout.
That's right.
5 minute timeout. Okay. Take care.
Thanks, Marianne.
Thank you so much for your help. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is America's Test Kitchen. Give us a ring anytime about cooking or anything else. 855-34-COOKS, 855-34-COOKS, or email us at questions@atkradio.com. Now it's time for this week's recipe challenge, homemade pasta. I'm here in the test kitchen with test cook Dan. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, Chris.
Rumor has it you're doing freshly made pasta without a machine, which sounds insane. I mean, I used to do it in the 70s, I used to do it with a machine, and then I gave up. And then I bought an electric machine and did that for a couple of years and gave that up. So I'm back to buying it in the supermarket. So really? I mean,
the rumors
why is it back?
The rumors are true, Chris. And trust me, I didn't go to Italy and become a master pasta maker. What I really wanted to do was come up with a dough that would be easy to work so that you could actually roll it out with a rolling pin. Not a lot of people like to have a pasta machine. It's an extra piece of equipment that only does one thing. So I felt that this was a really important recipe to come up with.
Okay, convince me.
All right, I will convince you. So, Chris, in Italy, the way they make pasta is they use a very finely milled flour called doppio zero. It has a minimum protein content of about 8%, 8 or 9.
You mean 0-0.
Exactly, 0-0. And so it has a protein content about 8 or 9%, and it produces a really stretchable, kind of light dough. So that's actually an easier dough to roll out just naturally than what we usually make here in the States, which is with all-purpose flour. So my first thought was maybe I can cut the gluten by using cake flour, or at least a portion of cake flour with some of the all-purpose, so that I had something a little bit stretchier. But the problem there is when I cooked off that pasta, it had a really pebbly texture on the outside. It was kind of a compromised noodle. And the reason that that was a problem is you need enough gluten or some kind of protein to kind of hold all that starch together. As it absorbs water and swells, it'll just exit the noodle.
Hmm.
So I ruled out flour pretty quickly. The next thing I looked at was hydration. So if you think about a bread dough, the more hydrated it is, the more water it has in it, the easier it is to stretch. So pasta dough is generally very low hydration, around 40 or 50%. And that's what makes it so dense and hard to roll out. So I tried adding water to it, but adding more water also led to more gluten development, which made it harder to roll and really produced a little bit tougher of a noodle.
So you just gave up. And this is store-bought noodles.
So then, exactly, Chris. And then I just got a box. No, there was another thing that I wanted to check out. And so fresh pasta obviously has eggs in it. That's what kind of defines it from the dried stuff that you buy in the supermarket. And so I really want to play with the ratio of eggs. The standard ratio is for 2 cups of all-purpose flour to use 3 whole eggs. And what I wanted to do is actually add extra yolks to the mix. Now, yolks have some water in them, about 50%, but they also contain lots of fat and emulsifiers. And those ingredients help limit gluten formation, with the added benefit that when that all hits the hot water, the egg sets and it holds the noodle together.
Huh.
So I went up and up and up, and I ended up landing on 2 whole eggs and 6 extra yolks.
Six extra yolks.
And you really get actually a very nice flavor from it. It's a rich pasta, but it's more reminiscent of what you would get in Italy, where they're using maybe farm fresh eggs. And a lot of times they'll add an extra yolk just for a little bit more.
And the
more
yellow. Noodles are probably good for breakfast.
Exactly.
Because you get so many eggs in it.
You got a lot of protein.
So 2 whole eggs and 6 yolks.
That's right.
Okay.
So then it's really easy from that point, Chris. We mix it in a food processor until it's a nice smooth dough, take it out, knead it a little bit, and let it rest for quite a while, at least 1 hour and up to 4 hours. And that's really important because the dough hydrates during that time, and then the gluten relaxes. So, Chris, what you end up with in the end is something that's actually very easy to roll out.
So we're talking, I just want to make sure I understand, you're talking about a counter flour in a rolling pin?
That's right.
Very medieval?
Very medieval.
Okay.
And the way it works, Chris, is there's a fair amount of fat in the pasta, so you don't really need that much flour. It actually doesn't stick all that much to the board. And you pick it up from time to time, and you keep rolling, and it's quite easy to get thin.
And how do you cut it into strips?
So once it's done being rolled out, I let it dry a little bit so that it's less likely to stick to itself, and then I roll it up into a nice little tube and just use a sharp knife to cut across that. And you can cut any width noodle you want.
Clever boy. Okay, good idea. So I see we have a pot of boiling water. The pasta's been dropped.
So this will just be another second.
So the hope is that this is going to be light years better than buying the dried pasta in the box.
Absolutely, Chris. I mean, okay. If you're looking at the egg pastas in the supermarket that are dried, this is going to be a lot better. So, Chris, we really want to taste the pasta here. It just has a little bit of butter and a little Parmesan here.
You know, it's interesting because what I've missed in pasta is flavor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the texture, I expected it would be very good. But what's really amazing is it actually has flavor, I assume because in part because of the eggs. But the stuff you buy in the supermarket, even if it's fresh pasta, there's no taste to it at all.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, and this has a really nice spring to it that you can only get in fresh pasta. And it's not al dente in the same way that dried is, but it's got a nice spring and bite.
Mm, this is really good. So the answer to the question, can you make handmade pasta at home that's worth the time and trouble? The answer is absolutely yes. Great flavor, great texture, actually turns out to be not that hard. Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to America's Test Kitchen. If you want to listen to more of our shows, or if you missed any of today's show, go to atkradio.com. We also post our recipes, taste test results, and kitchen equipment reviews. You can also email us anytime at questions@atkradio.com. This week, we chatted with the founders of the Museum of Food and Drink, and I did have a final thought. You know, it seems to me the human race is, for the most part, pretty silly. On one hand, we imagine the existence of infinite universes, yet on the other, we bend technology to the task of making a better breakfast cereal. It's almost as if we can't make up our minds. And that reminds me of Mr. Dick, the character from David Copperfield. He was an idiot savant, and his strange behavior was punctuated by moments of intense human kindness. We obsess over breakfast cereal, and then when it counts, we sacrifice for others. So if an alien race ever does visit our planet, I have a small suggestion. Serve them a bowl of Lucky Charms, and let the person sitting next to them be the Dalai Lama. It would, I think, be the best of both worlds. America's Test Kitchen Radio is produced by America's Test Kitchen in association with WGBH. Executive producers Melissa Baldino and Stephanie Stender. Senior audio engineer Douglas Shogarts. Segment editors Melissa Allison with Vicki Merrick and Sydney Lewis. Post-production by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media. Production help Debbie Paddock. Theme music, The Mahotel at Queens. Additional music, George Brandel Egloff. America's Test Kitchen Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange.